Hello, welcome to the libraries. Thank you for coming out this afternoon, especially given it's a homecoming weekend and a beautiful Friday. I'm glad to see everyone here. Today we have the honor of having Peter and Donna Thomas here from Santa Cruz, California. They've been traveling around the country, celebrating their 40th anniversary of being book artists and making some wonderful books. I'm not gonna do a bio because that's what they're gonna hear, be here doing. So without any further ado, here's Peter and Donna. Thank you.
So we want to thank you all for showing up on a Friday night before a big game. I mean, it's a big sacrifice, I'm sure, to be here rather than whatever else is going on. So we want to say we appreciate that. And I'll be doing most of the talking right now, but I'll ask Donna to come join. You can come join.
Yeah,
you
so
can
don't
ask-
worry if I interrupt. It's on purpose.
You can, yeah, you
it's,
can come.
It's
you
part
can
of
join
the plan.
You. Yeah, whenever you want, you can do that, okay. So. I like starting out with these two pictures just because it talks a bit about then and now. And I want to say that when this guy took the now picture, he probably took 500 pictures. It was for a local paper and they did an interview for our 40 years. And you know, he had his, and you can see how he got totally posed. And when this other one was taken, the guy came in and just went, it was black white film, took the picture and left. So the advent of technology has been a really, it has tracked our 40 years of making books. And it's really interesting how that's affected us as book artists. Because when we started out, the concept of art, book arts, was really only known to an abstract few. Most people who were involved in making books were thinking about making beautiful books. And there was this article, essay that went around, written by a lady named Beatrice Ward that was called The Crystal Goblet. In the Crystal Goblet essay, she said, would you prefer to drink your wine out of a glass, a crystal goblet, or would you rather drink it out of a coffee mug? And she said, would you rather read your book out of a crummy paperback or the most beautiful book you could possibly be holding? And she said, as artists, we want to make those most beautiful books. And so that's what we started with, thinking about making that kind of book. And then as,
what happened, all of a sudden, when the computer was invented in the 80s, a personal computer, and everybody had access to a personal computer, all of a sudden people could start getting words on a page without having to actually do the technology of a printing press, then all of a sudden things changed. The book was kind of freed. And aesthetically, the book was freed. Before, it was kind of in servitude to information. The book existed to get information from one place to another. But after the computer, the book no longer needed to be there to get the information from one place to another. So all of a sudden, the book as a form was free. And so you start to see in the 80s, right along with the personal computer, all of a sudden people starting to think about making books not just as literary vessels, but as artistic vehicles. And so it'll be interesting as you see our work go through this show, you'll see how it changes from being that earlier attempt to make the most beautiful book you possibly could. This is the first book I made. I hadn't quite learned the idea of making the most beautiful book you could possibly make yet. In fact, I didn't really know how to make a book. I wanted to be part of a Renaissance fair, and they said if I could figure out something to teach people, I could be part of the fair, because I wasn't a craftsperson doing anything. And so I decided to teach people how to bind books. And then once I had found a book on bookbinding, I saw one about papermaking next, and I thought, and I'll teach them how to make paper too. And then I became Peter Papermaker, and Don and I, for about 15 years, made and sold blank books at Renaissance fairs. So here we are in 1975. Aww. And fortunately, I was going to college at UC Santa Cruz, and in the college, they had a college press, a library press, and at the library press, there was a man, William Everson, who was a famous poet printer who printed his own poetry and other works. But he was nationally recognized as being a master printer, and students would work with him to print books at the library. And his most famous book was Granite and Cypress. That's the book on this side in my screen, on that side in your screen. And this is showing our book, The Alder, which was our homage to his early work. And you can see that down in the case downstairs. This book is owned by the library, and you can go look at this book. Now, there's a class here on process. I was thinking about this idea of how does an artist create their book, and I just want to just pause just a moment to talk about that with this book in case you have to leave early. And so Everson published the poems that are in his Granite and Cypress are the poems of Robinson Jeffers, his poetic mentor. And Jeffers wrote very long-lined poems. In fact, so long that none of the editions of any of his books of poetry ever printed the line in its full length. They always had to turn the lines. In other words, you couldn't read the single line of poetry. And so Everson wanted to print the poetry as a single line. So he made this very large, where the book was this size, with long lines of type. And he also in this book decided that since the page was so long, it was about this long, that on the back page, he didn't want the person to have to like step from place to place to read the poem. So he, on this side, all he did was he printed the image of the page behind, it was behind and backwards, so it had lightly ghosted backwards type on this page. So just an image you'd look at, and this would be the page you'd read. So, and then he bound the book in a regular cloth-bound book, but this cover here is cypress wood that was milled from Jeffers' Tor House home in Monterey, California. So the book with Jeffers' poems, Granite and Cypress, was bound in cypress wood. Now, I wanted to do some book to honor Everson, and I thought, what could I do? And I realized that he'd written a poem called The Alder, and I could print it in alder wood, and bound it in alder wood, cut from the same place that he had cut his alder. So that was the inspiration for making a book with a wooden cover, because we thought we could make a book that would include the works of our mentor, the poem of our mentor, and be able to bind it and reference back to his earlier work. So this was something that just how do you get into, what kind of book do you make? Why do you make a book? We either make our book because we want to get words somewhere, because we have images we want to share, or because we have a structure that we want to share. Books kind of go all those different ways. Our first printing was done in a printing class. My first printing, this was just when I was meeting Donna. And this was the first thing I printed. But this doesn't count in our celebrating of 40 years together because it's beforehand. There was something wrong with the formatting of that picture, huh?
I don't think so. No, that one is, yeah.
Yeah, I think, oh well, it was a good try. So we formatted our PowerPoint presentation on 3x5 and the screen is at whatever, 10x16. And so I'm afraid you're going to see a lot of short, fat people for the rest of the presentation. But these are some of the blank books that we made and sold at the Renaissance fairs. We made 100 books a week, and we did fairs, and we sold them on the weekend, and we would sell for 32 weekends a year. So and the only reason I mention this is we had a lot of time to gain bench skill. And really, the only way that you can get really good at something is by doing it a lot. Writers have to write a lot to be good, and binders have to bind a lot to be good. And we got our skill, our practice skill, by making these blank books. This was our first book. It was made on some copies were made, 10 on my own handmade paper, and there was 150 on commercial paper. There was a commercial binding, and then there was a binding that Donna wove the cloth for. So sort of shows our aesthetic of the time. We also printed a book on scraps of handmade paper that we'd used on that Everson book, and this is one of our early printed books, 79. In 1979, I also made my first Hollander beater for making paper, and making paper is very important to all of our work. We make all of the paper for our books. In 1980, we went to England, first saw paper being made by hand rather than by a professional, and I realized how to make paper better from that. Our first miniature book was made in 1980. This is the first miniature book. So when we made it, again, it was made of more scraps from that Granite and Cypress book. And I took it into a bookseller to show it to him. And he said, oh, that's cute. My brother likes stuff like that. Take it back to him. This was Mir Dawson. Took it back to Glenn Dawson. He pulled a ruler out of his pocket, measured it, and said, oh, that's great, but if it was a quarter inch shorter, I would have bought 30. And I said, what? He says, well, people only collect books, miniature books, but they only collect them if they're under 3 inches, and this measures 3 1/4 inches. You can see the influence of fine press printing in this book, how we have large, generous margins and decal edges on the paper. But when Glenn told us that, we cut the decals off, trimmed down the books, and made 30 books for him that were sized at 3 inches. And that's how we got started in our careers making miniature books. And what we found was that larger books, we couldn't really sell them because people like who we were learning from were making much better work than we were, and people would buy that instead. But with miniature books, our audience was non-discerning, and so we could sell almost anything we made, which gave us a lot of chance, again, to practice making miniature books. This is Glenn Dawson, our miniature book mentor, and this is a book that we made to honor him in 2000. He actually lived to be 103, and When I told him I was going to make a book with a timeline of his life, he said, can't you make one of those nice little traditional books like you used to make? And I said, no, I can't do that anymore, Glenn. And I made this book. And back like if I would have made a regular book, we would have sold them all out, but we still have all the copies almost because it's too crazy for all the miniature book collectors now. So we've gone from where they were completely non-discerning, I guess they love little books, and we are moving beyond the world of little books. This was our first book after learning how to make paper in England, Fire the Dragon You Drew, that we felt we'd make good books, really good books. You know, I feel somewhat limited by a slideshow, I have to tell you. The slideshow is a chronology, and it's sticking me to this chronology. I really like talking more about the work we're doing, so I'm going to fly through this chronology, and then I'm going to share some of our books with you and talk a little bit about each of the books. So I'm going to see if I can't speed up this whole little process here. And you can just see 81, 83, the first book that we could use with a photocopying machine. An interesting story. The photocopying machines then didn't make true color, so Donna printed a color wheel on the machine, adjusted all of her colors to how she wanted them based on the color wheel that she printed on the printer. There's an example of this in one of our cases over there. And here we are, 83, making and selling blank books, still at Christmas fair. This is a Christmas Victorian Dickens fair. And 85, here we are, the papermakers. We have two daughters, Tanya and Suzanne, now in their 30s. You can see the influence. Even then, we had the wagons with the gypsy wagon campers on them. It was a traditional sort of booth that people would use at the Renaissance fairs. So this is what our papermaking shop looks like now, rather than that rustic outdoor shop. We have all a studio where we can make up to 36-inch sheets of paper. We use often a double mold. Here's, and we have these little clips for hanging the papers to dry. This is our paper studio. Our print shop with the metal type, we print mostly from metal type. We do use polymer plates, and often we'll print from linoleum cuts or cuts that Donna makes. You'll see a lot of our books are made using digital printing technology too, but when we do digital printing, we use the copiers from a FedEx office, because those $1 million copiers are so good. This is a paper cutter for cutting stacks of paper, and then a guillotine for cutting cardboard. And then our bookbinding area where we work making books. Here's Donna in 1986 making our miniature books. This was another photograph taken by our lives are kind of documented by the local Sentinel paper. Every 10 years or so, they'll run an article on us making our own books and paper. And here's some examples of Donna's one-of-a-kind books that are made with leather bindings. That's on leather onlay, so the leather's paired very thin and then glued down in layers to make an illustration in the binding. Donna's made over 350 one-of-a-kind books, each with original illustrations, and many of them with the leather bindings. In 1987, our goal was to make, as it says here, to make a beautiful book with the finest materials and finest craftsmanship. We were really still at this point, 1987, thinking in the fine press vein of trying to make a beautiful literary work, that crystal goblet. Our book would be that crystal goblet. And here's Everson, my mentor, our printing teacher. And this is when we made our book of his poems called The Poet is Dead, where we felt like we made our first really successful large book. So we made it from 1977 to 1987. By 1987, we felt like we were finally kind of there. We could make some good work now. This, a fine press title page. We made maybe 30 variations of this title page with making the By William Everson in red and the other words in black. I mean, the things that fine press printers are thinking about is letter spacing on a page and placement of color. Something that's not really all that accessible to most artists. And that's, in fact, why we started to think about this, that rather than just being fine press printers, we really wanted to be fine book makers. And then maybe more than that, we wanted to make books that were artworks. And thinking about that, we thought about how, as we're not really building up a business where we can, like Random House, where we can sell the name and people would then be able to keep making books with the same. We're just artists making books. Nobody's ever going to make another book with that same name. So we decided to start using our names, Peter and Donna Thomas. This was one of the last Good Book Press book. And then we have a copy of this for you to look at. over there. So in 1988, I went to England to study how to make paper with this one man who I'd been introduced to. And he was the same person we saw at Wookiee Hole when we went there in 1980, and through a chance acquaintances. And this is really important because it was a turning point for us in learning how to make really, really good handmade paper. And our latest book, which is over there, Talking Ape People and Paper, is a documentation of our visits to that town. We took him to the paper mill and had him show us how to form the sheets of paper, which resulted in several projects. One was a DVD. It's got to go on YouTube now because nobody... So I wanted to show it to a student from Ann Arbor yesterday, and I said, well, do you have a flash drive ability to do a CD? No. How about an ability to do flash drive? No. Okay, I'm going to have to download it. And this is the Tuckanay People and Paper book that I was talking about over there. We made a number of books about papermaking through the 80s and 90s, and this was one of the first of them. And you can see this book, Papermaking in 17th Century England, on the table. We'll be glad to let you look at all of these books. This book is displayed in the case. It was how we met Eric Ahlstrom, your conservator here. He put on the show through the organization called the Guild of Bookworkers. Another book, Paper from Plants. Documenting people who made paper from plants. All these books we created as a way of documenting what was going on in the time. We're thinking that these would be resources for people 20, 30, 40 years now from now. They could look back and say what was going on in hand paper making. So at this point, we're still thinking of books as information, thinking of books as resources of information rather than thinking of them as artworks. But in this book, we started to think, even with paper from plants, how can we get the book to have more visual interest on every page? And that became kind of the key guidance for us, was how do we get to make the book more visually interesting on every page? So in 1992, we made our first bibliography, which listed 71 books. We're working on our current bibliography, which lists 160 books, plus the 350 one-of-a-kind books. I think I mentioned this about computers sort of freeing the book. So I see for us 1993 as being the kind of turning point when we really started to think about making books as art. And this was one of the first books that really started to pursue the idea of how can you make a book that has all the qualities of book in it, but when somebody looks at it, they go, that's not a book. But then they go, yes, that is a book. And you say, it's got text, it's got page, the page just happens to roll instead of turn. You can have a cover that you open. Or here's the same idea, pages that turn. Pages that turn, scrolling around. We've explored the idea of making scrolling books. It's through a lot of different work. There's one scrolling book in your collection here, which is a double scrolling, crossing over scrolling book. Then scrolling books led to flap books, and we started thinking about stick structures and how can we make books with every book of every binding we can invent would have some kind of have a dowel or stick integrated into it. This was our first attempt to make a book where the illustration and the text was in pulp. And rather than doing the illustration in pulp, the silent uprush of sap and plants, that was all done by stenciling a pulp onto a wet sheet of paper. And Donna made, the stencils remained, had its integrity to make enough 12 copies. And so we made 12 different copies of the book, each one completely different in illustration and structure. This was, by 1999, I was saying the copying, quality of copying became good enough that we could start making books using color copying to reproduce Donna's one-of-a-kind paintings and her one-of-a-kind books. Before that, the only way we could really illustrate our books was by wood blocks or photo engravings made of her line drawings. A number of Donna loves backpacking, so a number of her books document her trips and show using either one-of-a-kind paintings or additioned her paintings. And all the paintings that she included in these books were all painted on site in the Sierra. She carries some of our handmade paper and a paintbrush with her as she hikes. We did a few larger edition books with her paintings. Most of these are miniatures. I include the size so you can see. That was clever of me, isn't it? And right here you can see one of the books that we have on display now. You can see, even through these books, you can see how earlier on the books were all very traditional codex books, and now they're growing and becoming more and more innovative and interesting structurally. I have to apologize that most of the pictures have made all the books short and fat. So if you see them in reality, you'll be much happier. Donna got into a phase of tanning her own leather to do the leather bindings for her books. And a number of those were miniatures done with squirrel skins. Here's an example of one of the squirrel skin books. So the slideshow is moving us through our lives. And with this, you see what the different interests and how they manifest themselves in our artwork. Becoming very interested in making playing ukulele, I started to make books out of ukuleles. And there's a series of 23 different books out of ukuleles, where each structure deals with a different book kind of concept. So the one on the edge is on the right edge there, you can see it's a book ukulele. It's made out of a book. And then there's the altered book ukulele, where the whole book was glued on the outside of the ukulele. And so that was the game for myself. And I mean, you can look on the internet, just search ukulele books, and you'll find the website that documents all those. This is the sort of shrine ukulele book, ukulele fan book. And that led a little to, although at the same time, started thinking about making books out of objects and how can we integrate the beauty, the patina of age of an object into a structural book. And the accordion and concertina bindings were made because people incorrectly apply the word concertina to the folded book sometimes. And so we wanted to make sure that people understood that if a book is rectangular, you need to call it an accordion book. If it's octagonal or hexagonal, then you can call it a concertina binding. If you're new to the book arts, that won't make any difference. But if people have been involved with the book arts for a long time understand the visual pun and think it very clever, in fact. This book is the first paragraph of Cannery Row, and it was canned in a tuna can that was canned by a machine that came out of Cannery Row. And to read the book, you had to open the can. And so art people thought that was very clever. So in 2004, we made this book documenting all the structures that we had invented. And 2006, Donna decided that from her backpack that she'd like to do what John Muir did and just walk out of her home and walk to Yosemite. And so then the next year we found that nobody had ever done it before, nobody had ever traced Muir's footsteps. So we spent the next year sort of researching what Muir did. And then we actually did the walk in 2006. And then we spent the next year writing a guidebook for how to follow that route. And so there's no books for 2007. We didn't produce any of our one-of-a-kind artist books at that point. But then we made a few miniature books in the next few years, and we made actually a lot of Donna's one-of-a-kind turned into editioned work books in that time period. 2010, we took our first cross-country trip as wandering book artists. The goal of these trips was to visit. Well, first trip was to do collaborative work with other artists that we'd known over the years and never had a chance to visit, and also to visit the various libraries who we'd met the librarians, but we knew they'd never seen the full body of our work. It's easy to make stuff and it's hard to sell it, so we had a lot of books where we hadn't sold out the editions, and this gave us an opportunity to show the edition work to the librarians. Our wagon is outside, and if you're interested, we'll certainly let you have a tour of the wagon. We give talks, and we kind of use the wagon, since we think of ourselves as book artists, and we're telling people we're artists that make books, we figure if we have an artistic trailer, they'll believe us a little more. And it seems to work pretty good. Since 2010, we've taught hundreds of classes, and we've given hundreds of lectures as we travel across the country. It's been very, very entertaining to see the whole world, to be able to share our gospel of the book, and to really encourage people to visit rare book libraries, special collections, to see artist books. So all of you in the audience, I'm not going to make you do it, but I'd like you to have raise your hand and say, within the next 1 month, I will call up the special collections library and make an appointment and ask them to see a book on artist book on a subject I'm interested in. So you don't have to do it because I don't want to embarrass anybody, but within the next month, think about that, going to visit special collections and seeing some kind of book, especially those of you that are in that class that's having to make a book, you'll find some wonderful structures. If you tell them what your class is, what you're trying to do in your class, they'll be able to come up with a book that'll give you an explanation of how another artist did the same thing. We got very interested in using wood type to make the letters actual visual images rather than in fine press. The letter on the page is very important, and we thought we could with artist books we could start making the letter on page illustration more as much as it was a word. Here's our Everson's Alder book that I mentioned. This is the version that you have in your library, and all the books that we make that are in the case downstairs, you can call up in the special collections and look at them in person rather than just looking through glass. So we're in 2014. You can see how, if you think back to our first books, you can see how we've made this incredible sort of journey along with most other people who are interested in making books in this time period, from thinking of the book as a physical object, as a way to dress up a text, to thinking of a book as an artwork. And then there we are now. What's the best way? Okay, so. Whenever I get to a point like this in a talk, we'll see how this works. I always like to sing a little song. What's a book? I used to know, but things, they're really changing. So has anybody seen a book? I mean, recently, you know, some have pages and others don't. Some will tell a story my mother won't. Has anybody seen a book? Now imagine, I wrote this before the iPhone was invented. You got to keep that in mind. Now, if you want a book that would look like a book made in days of yore, if you want to see them, go to a museum or get yourself to an antique store. My book is 5x2, its screen is blue, more stories than a public library in it too. Has anybody seen my book? Do you think it's a ukulele? Has anybody seen my book? Aha. So this is the idea of a ukulele artist book. So that kind of follows through the chronology of our 40 years that we're celebrating. And I just want to take a minute. And Donna, you can give any advice you think might be. So one of the classes is attending the lectures on creating an artwork from concept to production, and they're going to be making a book out of at the end of their class. So I was going to talk about this book and how we thought of it. So first, we decided a poet we wanted to work with, and that poet's name is Naomi Nye. And we met her when we were teaching in San Antonio and printed a book of hers, and really enjoyed her poetry. And so when we're thinking, okay, well, what are we going to do now? What of her poems will we print? And we couldn't decide, so we wrote her and said, what poem do you want to have printed that you feel like never really got its proper due? And she sent back a poem called Sometimes I Pretend. And she sent it to us in the book it was published in. And the book it was published in was a regular codex book. And it had like two words stacked on top of each other in columns. And so I first said type like that. And I thought, no, this is not happening. This is not very exciting. And so then I thought I'd set it as a single line and make it a really long single line. And so I set a line like this that said, sometimes I pretend I'm not me. I just work for me. Then I couldn't figure out what to do with that, so I started setting it in different ways. Oh, interesting. That's exciting. Yeah, for those of you who can't see very well in the back, that is awesome. Should focus, here you are, great. Focus in on the typography, perfect, okay, great. Sorry, this is very surprising. I've never done this before. For you listening to this recorded tape, this is a first for me. And it's really exciting. And what you can't see is that they've got the screen showing the thing I'm holding up to show the people behind me. It's really, really exciting. And if you're there 20 years from now listening, you'll think, oh, that's so blasé. But just look at me right now if you can see the visuals. So I went back to trying some other ideas, and then I started to set some more. Some of these lines were set, and I started to put them together and stack them up. And I came up with this as a broadside, and I thought, well, I'll just fold it up into accordion. But then I looked at the center words, and you see the center goes secret motor and then churring. I was going to set churring in the typeface secret motor, but I ran out of letters, and so I had to change the typeface. And when I did that, I thought, that's the middle of the poem. It's like the key to the whole poem, and I should bind the book as a motor. And so you saw historically that we had made a bunch of books with scrolls and a bunch, one of them kind of looked like a motor, that one Pandora's Box. And so I thought, I could make a book like Pandora's Box but we can make it look like a motor. And Donna suggested, why don't you use some steampunk iconography? Because of the idea of the poem. This poem is like, well, if you've read it, you know, it's like Charlie Chaplin hanging from that clock thing, and the clock keeps going. He's like, wait for me. And this is how Naomi's feeling in her life. And like, hang on, you know, machines are taking over our life. And that whole machine thing is so key to steampunk. So Donna did these drawings, her illustration for the book with the pipes and the watches. And watches seem to really occur a lot in steampunk iconography. And so Donna started doing the watches with pencil dials because the poem references pencils. And then the pencils started to take over and be on their own. So the work started to have pencils in it. And then when we finished up the book, if you can remember back to the picture of the book about Pandora's Box, and it had a piece of cardboard here with the title printed on it, and it folded down as a cover. Because in that book, I wanted people to think of the box as a book. They'd open the cover, and it wouldn't have a page in it. And they'd think, oh, this isn't really a book. It doesn't have a page. And then they'd pull it out, and there would be the page. So in this case, we thought we could just use a pencil for the closure rather than having that whole page there. And then rather than knobs on the end, we thought gears to carry through with the gear thing. And then on the gears, with the Pandora box, excuse me, everybody here. With that book, people didn't know whether to turn it clockwise or counterclockwise to get it back in the box. So in this case, we put the words close on it so they would always know which way to turn it to close it. So the book got created by the poem. The poem itself dictated the structure of the book. Now, another example, I'll be back in a minute. For those of you that are looking at the camera, so the poem dictated structure. What would we want to show that were something else? Okay, this one. Same idea, but different. So this book, Paiute Creek, is a poem by Gary Snyder. Gary Snyder was a beat poet. He is still alive, so you'd have to say he still is a beat poet, but he moved on from beat poetry. He was the character Ryder Jaffe in Dharma Bums, written by Jack Kerouac. So he was the guy that took them all on the hike up the Matterhorn. He was studying Zen poetry when Kerouac met him. He was translating Zen poetry. And he was, Gary Snyder. Gary Snyder was very influential to California in the 70s, who loved the out-of-doors. He wrote poetry about the out-of-doors. And his seminal poem, when he found his voice from being a translator of Zen to becoming a California writer, was a poem called Paiute Creek. And I'd wanted to make a large scrolling book. You saw all of our little scrolling books. I thought I wanted to make one enlarged. And so the structure led me to think, okay, what poem is going to be perfect for the structure? And I thought, well, Gary Snyder, since he translated poetry from Japan, and the scroll is so Japanese, that it would be a good poem to put in the structure. And one of his poems would be a good one. And then I wanted to use that Paiute Creek poem. I had wanted to print it. We'd had permission for maybe 10 years, but we'd never figured out a book to do with it. So we thought, okay, we'll use the Paiute Creek poem. So the book opens just like some of those miniature ones you saw. We printed it with translucent ink, so you can see how you can see the illustration behind the blue. That was to give the illusion of the water. So we're thinking about, the poem is about a creek, so the type should make you think creek. So the type, you can see through it. The structure being a scroll, you can either read it by turning and seeing it as a small frame. Now we'd never, when we, When you see it like this, it sort of limits your view of the whole book, but it's still a very entertaining process for reading a book compared, because we're so used to reading codex books. But when the book was done, I all of a sudden realized that it would be nice if you could see the whole thing at once. So our original models for the binding had the dowels both fixed at both ends. And so after we had printed the whole thing and scrolled it through the first time when it was done, we started to think, oh no, we've got to make a new kind of structure. And that led us to think about how we could make the structure where you could pull the page out. And would you want to pull it out?
Yes, sure.
Mary Donna? We also wanted to make a really long scroll. So this is three pieces of paper stitched together. And the stitching then creates kind of a wave, so an allusion to the same thing, the water theme of the poem. The stitching creates that same water theme. So you can either look at the book with single pages or with it all the way scrolled up. And when you want to get it back, there's several ways of doing that, but the quickest one is to scroll it up like this. For those of you in audio land, I'm rolling up a scroll. And then we wanted to add one more little nuance to the book. You know when you read a poem and the first time you read it, you think something, and then you read, somebody tells you, but did you understand how this sentence tie together? And then you read it again, and you go, oh, that's awesome. I didn't get that the first time. And then you read it a third time, and you find something more. I wanted to have a little more in the book, a little more excitement. So a little excitement isn't quite the right word. I'm kind of stuck here because I'm being recorded, I can't like erase and back up. What we did was we decided we'd add the first thing that Kerouac credited Ryder Jaffe to saying in Dharma Bums. So the first thing that Ryder Jaffe says in Dharma Bums is mud is better than words. And that sentence is really a lot the same essence of the poem. The poem is talking about how when you're in nature, you just can't really think what to say because it's all so grand and all so amazing, and words fail us. So mud is better than words is kind of saying the same thing in a more simple way, a kind of Zen way. And so we printed this here in completely transparent ink, and then we gathered dirt from Paiute Creek and sifted it through miner sieves until we had just a powder. And then so we'd print this in transparent ink and then dust it with the powder and then dust everything off, and that's what made the ink appear that color. And then having that color of ink, the illustrations here were printed with a key block. The illustrations are made with sprayed pulp. So these illustrations of water are made by spraying pulp. So it's kind of another way of making watery illustrations. And then the linoleum block, or the brown, we chose an ink to match the same color as the dirt of Paiute Creek. So when we decided how to cover the book, what are we going to do? We'd made some crinkled paper before, and it was a technique we liked, and we thought we'd like to include in this book. Then we realized that there was a process that Japanese artisans used to crinkle paper for clothing, and they do it by coating a certain kind of preparation made from persimmons on paper, and it turns it sort of leathery, and when you crinkle it, the crinkle retains. So we got some of that persimmon powder and treated the paper for the cover with that, and that's what made the crinkly textures. Now, none of these things really matter. You may never know them, but for us as artists, these all add just this another layer of integration, of wholeness to the work, so that the work really then has a whole aesthetic wholeness to it. So there's two books that I can tell you a little bit about the process. And do you have anything you'd like to add, Donna? Mm-hmm. Well, it's just about time to wind down the lecture because of the 45-minute time limit that we have for my own entertainment. But for those of you in the audience, that little thing just, my little microphone just fell off because it got stuck on the book as I walked away from it. But it was no real problem. So I wanted, before I leave, to let you know that, you know, I was talking about the computer setting the book free. I really believe that in the 21st century, the book arts are to become the dominant art form. I really think that, I mean, sculpture and painting are pretty boring compared to a book. Book has sculpture and it has painting and it has words in it. I mean, but the problem is most people haven't taken Book Arts Education 101 or Book Arts Appreciation, where the lecturer can explain how much better books are than paintings and sculptures. So we've got a whole world full of uneducated people, and we're just waiting for these classes to appear. So kind of part of my lecture, all these talks we've given is a little bit of this missionary work for the book. And when the book does actually become the dominant art form later in the 21st century, I figure all those book arts practitioners are going to really need to have songs to sing. You know, they'll want to have book arts folk songs. And so I'm encouraging anybody who has any connection with Spotify to ask them to create a book arts folk song channel. And we've made, of course, the first book arts folk song CD for you to buy and listen to when you're making your artist books. And yeah, I'm sure that you all know a number of these songs already. They're really famous. You know, like, bookbinding gals, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. I'm sure you know a lot of them already. So don't be shy to join in the new movement of singing artist books folk songs. But so I can see that there's a number of people that are just dying to ask questions. So if anybody does have a question, I'd be glad to try to answer it. Yeah. Yeah. Help me out here, Donna.
We can talk about that. I'm not sure the answer.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Okay, so that was one question we couldn't answer. How about one we can? All right, don't want to put anybody on the spot. Oh, yeah?
Do you prefer using your homemade paper over any other paper?
Thanks for asking a question. Again, I felt so... I don't often give a talk with a PowerPoint, so it doesn't allow me to really address a lot of the subjects that are really important to us as book artists. And yes, the fact that we make our own paper gives us incredible freedom. First off, our paper is really strong. And so we can do a lot of things that people who buy a regular commercial paper can't do. These scrolling structures, if you try to make them out of regular photocopy paper, it'll rip really quickly. Our paper is like, it's like making a scroll out of dollar bill. You know how strong a dollar bill is. Our papers like that. We can control the texture. Don, if you got the one with the texture, the plant press book, yeah. You can show, we'll show that. So we can make a book, we can come up with an idea. The book that Don is bringing over here is called Hetch Hetchy Flora. And the idea of the book is it's like a plant press. And the paintings that she has is like the flowers collected in a plant press. And so the paper that we made, she wanted, Donna came up with the idea of making the paper that was both like looked like granite and also was the texture of blotter paper. And so we can make paper like that. And you can see the little flex to get the granite in. Now, of course, any artist can take a piece of paper and treat it to change it. That's what painters do. They make a canvas, a flat canvas, look like something else. But we can create very interesting substrates. And so it's a wonderful thing to be a paper maker. One thing that I didn't talk about specifically in the Sometimes I Pretend book and in the Pirate Creek book, both of those books have illustrations made by spraying pulp. And we learned to do that in 2010 on our first trip, and it's a really exciting thing to us that we can now be paper makers, but doing our make our illustrations with a technique that only paper makers can master. So we're doing printmaking using sprayed pulp through stencils, which is something that only a paper maker can do. So it's really exciting that we're kind of, each one of our latest books, we tried to figure out how can we add the pulp painting into it, because we're just finding more and more interesting things we can do with that technique. So, yes. Yes, please.
You both got your start making these books for Renaissance fairs, and when you were learning how to do that, were there any books on bookmaking, any sort of instructions that were helpful?
We were very disadvantaged at that time. There was only one book that we could find at bookbinding when we first started. That was called Pauline Johnson's Creative Bookbinding. It's no longer something that I'd recommend. I'd recommend our own book, More Making Books by Hand, as being one of the best books for basic instruction. And we have other people that believe that too. There's a really lot of information available now. There were really no book arts classes. But what we were craftspeople. Both Don and I liked making things. And we also had an inclination for perfection or for trying to make things better and mastering our skills. And so I guess I said it then, but we made our first books were pretty crummy. You saw that picture of the first book, and we knew it was crummy, and so we thought, what can we make it better? Okay, it's got to get rid of those glue stains, and then got to get the corners to be tighter. We just, and by making so many, we got better. And so that, as I said, that was the trick. Just, an old guy one time, he came by the fair, and he says, yeah, you just can't buy experience. You know, you gotta do it. But now you have a lot of ways to learn to buy, but there's so many opportunities to take classes. But for us, that wasn't the case. I like that, a historical question and an aesthetic question. And are there any others? Yes.
I think your point about the book becoming unbound or freed by digital books is really interesting. I think it's also interesting because I think digital books have assumed that sort of captivity in a way. It seems like e-books are sort of bound by the structure that physical books once held. And given your interest in sort of technology and the way technology has informed your works, I'm wondering if you would be interested in making digital book art or thinking about along those lines.
I like that question because it is something I think about a lot. When I talk about a book artist, I think of a book artist as a person who makes artwork in the medium of the book. So they're thinking in terms of a book when they're making their work. And there are digital artists who think of their web page sequences as books. The problem is they don't have the same dimensionality as a book. And I always talk about this thing, I call it the Mona Lisa of the book. Like, you know, the Mona Lisa is supposed to be the greatest painting that ever existed. So what would this greatest book, this greatest artist book that ever exists be? Well, it'd have to have structure. All these books have structure. It'd have the greatest structure, it'd have the best materials, it'd have the greatest literature, the greatest illustrations. And so for me, I think a digital book, because it can't have three dimensionality, would really be lacking. I don't think it could ever be the greatest work, but yet certainly there's got to be, just like within religion, there's like so many different ones. There's Zen religion, and there's Christianity religion, and there's just, you know, and then within Christianity, there's like this and this and this. Within the book arts, there's so many schools. There's going to be somebody that's like the Michelangelo of digital books, and when somebody sees that, they're going to go, my God, why didn't we ever think of this before? But that hasn't happened quite yet, and that's not what I'm interested in, or Donna, as artists. We're really interested in this marriage of physical materials and visual imagery and text to create an object that when somebody looks at it, they have an aesthetic experience, and that aesthetic experience, what I'd hope is a little bit of pleasure, a little bit of amusement, and a little bit of awe in the materials or the craftsmanship. That's what I'd hope would kind of happen. That's great. That's a theoretical question. We're covering the whole bases. Yeah.
Have you used origami, kirigami, or suminagashi? Folding, cutting, or marbling techniques?
So have we used suminagashi, the other nagashi, or origami in our work? You know, we've specialized in Western paper making, and we learned Western fine press printing based on the Gutenberg Bible as our role model, you know. And so we never drifted too far on an actual level into any of the Oriental or any of the Japanese papermaking arts, but you can see how that, but yet we allude to them through using the scroll. We did come a really wonderful work where we collaborated with a fellow named Chris Palmer, who is one of those people that can fold paper, origami things. And when we made this book that the library is just getting, it's called The Tarantella Rose. I'm sort of afraid to walk over there. Yeah. But Don will show you this book, The Tarantella Rose. And this book was three poems. Turn to the title page, too. There are six poems by our printing teacher, William Everson. We showed you that book, The Poet is Dead, which was the first one we made. And this Tarantella Rose was the second book of his poems. And the third book we made of his poems was The Alder. And when we made this book, the theme of of the rose was followed through in the poems. And so we carried that through in the title page, and then and even in the binding, we thought of this as a lattice work that would hold a terrace of roses. And so for the cover, the special bindings, we often will do four or five or six books that are very special in some way, have a more sculptural binding or have hand-colored illustrations or something. For the special ones in this, we bound them in with a leather spine, and this paper artist actually folded a rose out of a single sheet of paper that collapsed it down to a small size so that we could actually, from one single sheet of paper, had the origami rose in the middle of it, and then we bound that on the cover of the book. So that's the only time we've really done that, but that was a really successful collaboration of one artist's skills with another, which leads to an interesting thing about the book art. So most people think of art as where one lone genius is making stuff, and then they cut off their ear, and everything they ever made gets stuck in a gallery while people go and stare at it in awe. That's kind of like what art is, something you go and stare at in awe, and the artist is this crazy person making stuff. And the book arts is really interesting because it's really, the collaborative nature of it can show so clearly. Like in a painting, it doesn't really show that somebody made the brushes, that the painter didn't really know how to make their own brushes, and it doesn't really show that the painter didn't really know how to weave their own chiasmus, and it doesn't really show that the painter didn't know how to grind their own pigments. And so some people are somewhat critical of a book artist who doesn't make their own paper and print their own book or bind their own book. But a book artist isn't really limited to having to actually do all the parts themselves. They can hire other people to do the parts, and still, they're like the conductor in an orchestra, where they conduct the violins and they conduct the bass and they create the symphony out of that. So that's another really interesting thing about book arts, that it can be very collaborative in making the final creation, that is the artwork that has that aesthetic impact that a symphony has by the creation, by the combination of all these separate wholes. So that is yet to really be seen at its finest too, the collaborative artist book where they somehow work with all those different parts together.
MSU Libraries has been involved in art books for many years, and I wonder what you think of our collection. I hope we have the same answer, but we have many art books. What do you think of the work we've done?
So you're asking, what do I think about the collection here?
Yes.
At the university? Well, one thing about being a book artist, when we were first making that transition from being fine press printers and craftspeople to being artists, about that time when we changed our name from being the Good Book Press to Peter and Donna Thomas, we really wanted to see our work in museums. Because we were thinking, we're artists, come on. And art and museums weren't buying books. They didn't think of them as artworks. They would think they're books. They can't be artworks. They're encumbered by function. They're not artworks. And museums weren't, and they still, museums don't buy books really as artworks. They'll buy books for their library, but not as artworks, only as literary. So it took a while for us to realize that libraries are actually museums for books. But now we clearly understand that libraries are the place that are the repositories for artists' books, much like museums are the repositories for paintings. Museums are kind of stuck in their, and that they can only show things that are two-dimensional or three-dimensional, but they can't show things that are four-dimensional like books. There's no way that they can really allow somebody to sit down and have that experience of turning the pages. But when you come into a special collections, you can actually do that. And so I think any special collections library that has fine press and artist books is a real asset to the community and an asset to the world, because they're preserving them for a later time and for public viewing. And your library has made a commitment to collecting artist books in the last 10 years, where before they really only collected antiquarian books or books by subject. Now the library here will actually allow their curators to buy a book because it's an artist book, not because it's something on trains and they collect book on trains. And I think that that's a really, it is innovative, and I think it's the wave of the future. And we see other libraries making that same decision, allowing their curators the liberty to create a collection based on their vision of what kind of artist books do they want to show in their collection of artist books. Much like they allowed the curators the vision to say, I want to collect comic books. And if they had said, we only allow you to collect 18th century literature, your institution would not be the greatest place to come and see a collection of comic books, which is what Michigan State?
Where am I now?
Where am I? I didn't want to say the other your crosstown rivals down there in Ann Arbor. I didn't want to call it the wrong one. But here you've got one of the greatest collections of comic books, and researchers could come to see that. In the future, I believe researchers are going to come to see these transitional works of artwork in book forms, and you're going to have a good collection here, and I think that's really great. And that's why we're pleased to have we're celebrating 40 years of artist books, to one of our shows of the celebration is here, and that's why we're here celebrating now. And so we want to thank the university for having the show of our work and for collecting our work and the work of others. We want to thank you all for coming and attending this lecture. And I want to end it now by inviting you to come look at the books. And we only have two rules for looking at the books. One rule is if your hands are clean enough to wipe off on your shirt when you have your best Sunday shirt on, then they're clean enough to touch our books. If they're not, go and wash them off. And the second thing is when you're looking at a book, pay attention to it. Remember how you opened it, because it's like a puzzle. And if you'd taken Book Arts 101, you'd know to do that, to treat a book like it's an artwork. And if somebody comes and you're looking at the book and they, you know, you're standing there very carefully looking at your book and they say, hey, what about the big game on Friday? You would say, excuse me, I'm looking at an artist book. I'll talk about the big game when I'm done. So thank you very much for letting us talk to you. Our books are over here. And please come and look at them.